Who are you stepping over? There was a certain old recluse who lived deep in the mountains of Colorado. And when he died, distant relatives came from the city to collect his valuables. Upon arriving, all they saw was an old shack with an outhouse beside it. And inside the shack, next to a rock fireplace, was an old cooking pot and his mining equipment. A cracked table with a three-legged chair stood guard by the tiny window, and a kerosene lamp served as a centerpiece for that table. In a dark corner of that little room was a dilapidated cot with a threadbare bedroll on it. Well, they picked up some of the old relics that they thought were like antiques, and they started to leave. As they were driving away, an old friend of the recluse on his mule flagged them down. "Do you mind if I help myself to whatever's left in my friend's cabin?" "Go right ahead," they said. After all, they thought, what inside that shack, it could be worth anything. Well, the old friend entered the shack, walked directly over to the table. He reached under it and lifted one of the floorboards, and he proceeded to take out all the gold that his friend had discovered over the past 53 years. It was enough to build a palace. The recluse died with only his friend knowing his true worth. As the friend looked out the little window and watched the cloud of dust behind the relative's car disappear, he said, "They should have got to know him better." Back when I was a teenager in the church's youth group, I don't know why all church youth groups do this occasionally, but they do. We once tried what I call an exercise in trust. Maybe you've done something similar. Each of us took a turn. We faced away from the group. And the person whose turn it was to fall backwards, expecting to be caught by the others. Taking that fall is not easy. Some of us could not go for more than a few inches before we regained our balance and stood back up. There was a lot of laughter in this exercise, but also a lot of feelings of embarrassment that we just couldn't let go. I was reminded of this exercise in trust when I was reading something from the author Mitch Albom. Some of you have read some of his things. He recalls an unusual class from way back in his college days. The professor of the students participated in that very same trust exercise I just mentioned. And there too, the results were hesitation, embarrassment, and laughter. One student redeemed the whole thing. A thin, quiet, dark-haired girl who almost always wore those bulky white fisherman sweaters, you see. She crossed her arms, closed her eyes, leaned back, and didn't even flinch. For a moment, it looked like she was going to hit the floor in a big thump. But at the last instant, her assigned partner reached out, grabbed her head and her shoulders, and laid her down carefully. Several students yelled in support. Some clapped. The professor then pointed out that the girl had closed her eyes, and that made all the difference. There's another example of trust that appears in the parable that Jesus told and that we're looking at today. The two people in this parable both fell backwards. One is unable to trust and cannot be caught. The other closes his eyes, falls backward, and is caught by the one who is standing behind him. Now, the trustful one we know as Lazarus. That's because Jesus names him, and he's the only person Jesus ever names in a parable. Jesus doesn't give a name for the other man, but refers to him simply as the rich man. Christian tradition labels him as Dives. Maybe you've heard that. It's the Latin word for rich man. So let's call him Dives too. You can imagine the life that Dives enjoyed. You really can. He dressed in fancy clothes. They mentioned purple robes. That's a sign of wealth and royalty. Dives would eat very well, and he would do so day after day. He's quite a consumer, Dives is. He wants for nothing in life. So preoccupied with his own happiness and his own indulgence that he simply doesn't notice, or he completely ignores poor sick Lazarus, who's lay right on his doorstep, lying there on his manicured lawn. Well, maybe they didn't have those, but you get the idea. Dives' pet dogs, or they could have been wild dogs too, find their way to Lazarus, and they lick the poor man's sores. But Dives still doesn't notice his neighbor in terrible need. No, he may see Lazarus there. He might even know his name. But all to no avail. He simply, truly decides not to recognize him. Now, it's really important for us to understand that Dives does not oppress Lazarus, per se. He doesn't cheat him. He doesn't exploit him. He simply does not notice him, or he ignores him. In time, Jesus goes on to say, Dives dies. Perhaps his death was premature due to all the rich food he had and ignoring his doctor's advice. Well, we don't know that. But his funeral was probably a great big deal. Everybody would have come to it. The burial plot, or the tomb that he was in, was a beautiful tomb. But Dives finally finds himself in a place of torment. He complains that this place that he's in is hotter than hell. And then suddenly he realizes to his astonishment that that's exactly where he is. He's in hell. Dives looks around, and there in the distance, very far away from him, well beyond the boundaries of his torment, he sees the brilliant figure of Abraham and somebody sitting beside him. Certainly to have a chat with Abraham, well, that would be a prize seat for anyone who was in the departed. But the face of that other figure, well, it looks familiar to Dives. And then Dives finally recognizes that this is the poor homeless man who once sprawled across his front door and was such a nuisance to his dogs. Dives has not lost any of his haughtiness. Did you notice that? He hails Abraham as one might signal a less than competent waiter. Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus to cool my tongue with the tip of his fingertip. These flames are frightfully uncomfortable. Same old Dives, isn't he? He's absorbed with himself. He thinks he deserves special treatment in that place. And that Lazarus is somehow available to be his personal lackey and come and serve him. The answer is no, of course. And Abraham gives it to him easily at first. First, the universe does, however slowly, always bend towards justice. Dive's whole life was a holiday, while Lazarus, on the other hand, had it lousy in life. The death of both of them brought about a great reversal, didn't it? Now it's Lazarus' turn to sit in at poolside, enjoying a cool drink with the big boys, while Dives is doomed to sizzle like fat in a frying pan. Secondly, Abraham points out that where he is and where Dives is separated by a great gulf, an insurmountable no man's land. That's probably a way of Jesus describing the chasm that existed in Dives' heart. So Abraham finds himself unable to have room service come and visit Dives down in Hades. That's just the way it is. Dives is not in the habit of taking no for an answer. So he makes another request, one where he sounds like a good family man. "Then I beg you, send Lazarus to my father's house and warn my five brothers to clean up their act. Otherwise, all six of us will sizzle here together." And Abraham replies that the brothers can get on the right track if all they do is read and heed the Bible, the prophets, and Moses. Dives counters with a suggestion, a plea, an original idea. He knows his brothers. A whole lot of them are in a sad sight when it comes to ethics and religion or just plain decency. But if someone were to come back from the dead, heart thumping again inside their shroud, then even these morally challenged, self-indulgent boneheads will finally sit up and take notice. Once again, what Dives proposes is shot down by Abraham. The old patriarch responds, "You've missed the point by a mile. The resurrection business is not about reviving corpses so they can go another 100,000 miles. The kingdom of God is not the old life you remember. It's not about great meals and fine tailoring or brilliant colors that you enjoy. If we send Lazarus to your brothers, he'll startle them. But their hearts won't change. They'll still play by the same crooked rules, and they'll just assume the game goes on forever." Try to understand, Dives. What we're about here is a whole new order. And strange to say, it works through failure and loss and death. Nobody can strut their way in. To enter, you must fall backwards, eyes closed, believing that you will be caught. Lazarus is here beside me, and I'm picking up the tab because he's someone who knows how to take a fall. His whole life amounted to one big shove. But he closed his eyes, and he trusted it that the arms would be there to catch him. And he died into life. You, on the other hand, Dive, sorry to say, you lived into death. It wasn't the money that was the problem, it was you. You could never accept loss or failure. Not even the tiny ones you were dealt with in your well-endowed existence threw you for a loop. You always had to be a winner, and you succeeded. You won big. But really, you lost even bigger. You refused to die to yourself because you didn't believe that arms were there to catch you. Even when you closed your eyes as your body shut down, you refused to let go and fall into life. I'm sorry, Dives. I really am. And with that, Abraham sighs, turns away, and walks off with his arm around Lazarus while I added that. And Dives never sees him again, as far as we know. This parable is quite shocking. And that's deliberate. Sometimes you and I, we need hard words. We need hard images to drive a point home. And Jesus did that quite often. Jesus has been preaching consistently and constantly that the gospel is about death that leads to life. You must lose your life to find it. This is something Dives cannot figure out. He's still clinging to his ego, his status and pride. He won't let go of the world as he constructed it, even while he's sitting in Hades being tormented. You see, Dives is dead, but he hasn't died. He's in Hades, but he hasn't died the death that leads to life. A life that's worth living. This is the lesson Jesus wants so desperately for us to learn. How do you communicate such a complex and multi-layered truth to people like you and I. Well, you tell a shocking story and you embellish it with some gruesome details like dogs licking sores. It's a brilliant storytelling. It really is. And it is a story that's now been preserved for thousands of years. It is a story that was directed at Jesus' listeners who needed to begin the hard work of probing the condition of their own hearts, to consider how the darkness of one's heart manifests itself in life. And in this case, the darkness reveals itself in Di's failure to love his neighbor, a neighbor who was right on his doorstep. It is a story about individual sin, but it's sin that leads to real suffering on a societal level. The great chasm between rich and poor is represented by the chasm between Dives and Lazarus. It's a parable that speaks directly into the heart of our society and each of us. Our inaction in caring for our neighbors is literally creating hell for them. Jesus' parables were directed at those who saw themselves as God's people, people who believed that they were in. They were secure in their knowledge that they were God's chosen and covenant people. It's shocking, but in this story, those who believe they were in, like Dives, are the ones in danger of going where? The Hades. You know, confession time, I guess. Christians are notorious for believing that they're in, and that their unbelieving neighbors are out. There is a kind of arrogance about how we see others sometimes. We think that if we don't believe the right things, or we will end up like Dives. Surprisingly, though, Jesus never talks specifically. This is interesting. Never talks specifically of our need to believe things. But rather, he's concerned about the nature of our hearts. Jesus doesn't really care about your theology. Rather, he cares about how you treat your neighbor. Do you love them? It's not about avoiding burning in hell's fires, but about dousing the flames that are making life hell for people here and now. It's not about trusting in our own righteousness that we think we know the right things and that we do the right things, because our righteousness, according to Isaiah, is nothing but filthy rags. It's always about Christ's righteousness, demonstrated by him and set as an example for you and I. I found something that was profoundly convicting. It's from a book called 1500 Inspirational Quotes and Illustrations, and then retold by Charles Swindoll, but it's by M. Lund, and this is what he wrote. I was hungry, and you formed a humanities club and discussed my hunger. Thank you. I was imprisoned, and you crept off quietly to the chapel in the cellar to pray for my release. I was naked. In your mind, you debated the morality of my appearance. I was sick, and you knelt and you thanked God for your own health. I was homeless, and you preached to me the spiritual shelter of the love of God. I was lonely, and you left me alone to pray for me. You seem so holy, so close to God, but I'm still very hungry and lonely, cold. So where have your prayers gone? What have they done? What does it profit a man to page through the book of prayers when the rest of the world is crying for help? Brothers and sisters, we are here at this worship service to honor Jesus Christ. He tells us this story, but more than that, by his own example, he shows us what it means to die into life. He's not afraid to close his eyes and let go and fall backwards, because he believes there will be arms there to catch him. He tells us those arms are there for us too. By his word and example, we learn that the kingdom is not a place into which we can just strut. If we enter, we must close our eyes, let go, and fall backward, believing that we will be caught. This needs to happen at the end of our earthly existence, but I also believe it needs to happen many times throughout our lives. It's all a trust experience. We can live into death as Dives did, or like Jesus and Lazarus and every saint, we can die into life. So I tell you, close your eyes, lean back, and let go.